It is indeed a privilege to be with you this afternoon. I want to, first of all, thank Dr. Pipa. He came on my webcast a couple of months ago, and I was able to cajole him into affirming publicly that it is required of first-time speakers to wear a green bow tie. This allowed me to finally remove the tie that I have on today from my Amazon wish list, where it had languished all through the Christmas season, my family refusing to purchase it for me. And so I was able to give them... Well, it's got green in it. It's close enough. And I also, I think you all need to thank Dr. Murray as well. You do not know the great favor that Dr. Murray has done for you. Because he preached last night, I feel no compulsion whatsoever to do my entire presentation in my best Scottish accent, which I would have felt had he not been here to speak with you last evening, you see. And we were just speaking, and he and I have some common friends in Scotland, in fact, in Glasgow. Jim Handyside's a good friend of ours, is he not, you know? And once I spoke like this whilst preaching at Jim Handyside's church, and that evening he said to me, "Brother," he said, "Brother, I must tell you something. Your Scottish accent sounds to me like a mixture of Italian and Pakistani." I haven't quite recovered from that, but I'm trying. I really am trying. It is a privilege to be with you, and I have a lot to share with you, and so I need to jump right into it. My topics, the two topics I've been assigned, one I'm very thankful for. I will thank Dr. Piper for that. The other one on Peter Enns, I am not thankful for, and I will blame Jeff Downs for that, for those of you who know Jeff. But today we'll be looking at Bart Ehrman. There he is. There's Brother Bart back there. Why should I talk to you about Bart Ehrman? Well, first of all, I've had the opportunity of debating Dr. Ehrman, spending a fair amount of time studying his writings and his materials. But why should you care about Bart Ehrman? Well, I believe that you are looking at probably, and now I can't even see my own notes. Look, I know there's a glow off of the forehead, but it's not that bad. Thank you. We'll keep that one up. Thank you. I believe you are looking at a picture of probably the most well-known leading critic of New Testament Christianity in the United States today. And as we look at his background, you will see why it is that the unbelieving world has latched on to anything that Bart Ehrman has to say. Now, Bart Ehrman does not say a whole lot of new things. He actually repeats a lot of the old arguments that many of us have been responding to for a long time. But because of who he is and where he came from, an unbelieving media, an unbelieving culture, looking for and longing for reasons to unbelieve, repeat what he has to say over and over and over again. He was raised as a nominal Episcopalian, where he had a born-again experience sometime, I would assume, around his sophomore year in high school, as he has described that particular experience. As a result of that, he decided that he needed to go and get further theological education. And so from 1973 to 1976, he was at Moody Bible Institute, where he will often remind us that Moody Bible Institute, where Bible is our middle name. And as a result of graduating from there, chose to go to Wheaton College, where he graduated in 1978. But then he went on from there to Princeton Theological Seminary, where he did his MDiv and PhD, graduating in 1985. He was one of the last PhD students of Dr. Bruce Metzger. And some of you have seen Metzger's Introduction to Textual Criticism, his summary of the New Testament. The fourth edition of that was co-edited with Bart Ehrman. And so many people view Bart Ehrman as Metzger's protege, as his successor, in essence, the mantle falling upon him, the problem being, of course, that Metzger did not become an agnostic, as Bart Ehrman has in the years since his graduation in 1985. Right now, he is the department chair of the Department of Religious Studies, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, which those of us over in the West Coast, we think anything over on here, North Carolina, must be conservative. Not quite. Not exactly a bastion of conservative viewpoints. He is the James A. Gray Distinguished Professor there at the University of North Carolina. And from that, he then is able to promulgate his views. Primarily, he certainly is seen on NPR. I'm going to show you some video clips here in a moment. But primarily through the books that he is writing. If you're going to send your young person to any secular university, the chances are they're going to run into Bart Ehrman's books as textbooks. That's where the real impact here is. He is impacting the teaching of New Testament and the history of Christianity in secular universities and even, quote-unquote, Christian universities all across the United States. Now, let's look at some of his books so you can see what I'm talking about here. The Orthodox Corruption of Scripture is his 1993 work that really has, he really hasn't done anything beyond this. This was a groundbreaking work in the sense that it charted a major move in the study of New Testament manuscripts in the academy today, and we are still feeling its effects to this very day. Dr. Ehrman, along with some other scholars such as Dr. Epp and others in the United Kingdom, have in essence come to the conclusion that we've gone about as far as the manuscripts are going to take us. And so now what they are in essence doing is not worrying so much about the establishment of the original text of the New Testament through textual criticism. Now it's become, well, let's see what we can find out about the scribes and about what the scribes believed by analyzing the changes that they made. So while historically the emphasis had always been that the reason their variations is because of scribal error, Dr. Ehrman is emphasizing the idea that these scribes made purposeful changes. And what we need to do is we need to start climbing into their heads and, in essence, doing some type of psychoanalysis from distance. And that's where a lot of New Testament studies are now going as a result. And that is not something that should be any way, shape, or form encouraging. That's not something that is a good thing at all. This particular work has been criticized. Even Metzger criticized it on a number of grounds, but it has had a tremendous impact in the academy as well. But almost no, how many people in here have read that book? Yeah, see, that's what I mean. Thank you very much, bald man in the back, very good. All right. had hair before he read it too, I imagine. But yeah, so have I, but it has that effect. Obviously, the biggest impact that Bart Ehrman has had is through his much more popular books, which frequently end up being New York Times bestsellers. For example, in 2005, we have Misquoting Jesus. And this particular work was, in fact, the thesis that he insisted we debate last January when we debated in Florida, January of 2009. He didn't want to get any more specific than this. But in essence, it is the assertion that we can't really know what Jesus actually said because of scribal changes and because of the transmission of the text of the Gospels in particular. He focused primarily upon that area because he's gone on since then to address other works, such as, well, as we'll see in a moment, a book called Jesus Interrupted. But that Misquoting Jesus got him all sorts of very popular media appearances, wherein he was able to promulgate the idea that we simply can't trust what has come down to us today. He gives a part of the truth, but he doesn't give all of the truth of the situation. He's careful with his facts. Very rarely do you catch Bart Ehrman giving you a false fact. It's the milieu, it's the context in which it is placed that is important. And then, of course, with a willing media complicit in the situation, they then take his conclusions far beyond even where he himself would take them. And I must fault Dr. Ehrman for not challenging them in so doing. Well, continuing looking, at least somewhat in a chronological way, Another major book that came out that, again, probably no one here has read, simply because it's a Brill book, and if any of you have priced Brill books, I think this one was $165. Studies in the Textual Criticism of the New Testament is a collection of all of his scholarly articles into one place, one book. And at least one of the things that I did before debating him was obtain all of these things. It was ironic that I'm not really certain that Dr. Ehrman had taken the time to Google my name before debating me. That is something that I have discovered when debating liberals and those on that side of the spectrum. They don't believe we have anything meaningful to say, so they don't bother to prepare for debates. It's only our side that takes the time to listen to the other side and accurately represent it. And I think we have to continue doing that. Whether they do so really isn't the issue. We have to be very faithful to the truth. Then in 2008, Dr. Ehrman came out with another book, and it shows, I think, a progression to where he is leaving his specific field of expertise. What I mean by that is, clearly, Dr. Ehrman's PhD was specifically in the identification of the proto-Alexandrian text type in certain Egyptian manuscripts. That doesn't exactly equip you to write a book called God's Problem, How the Bible Fails to Answer Our Most Important Question, Why We Suffer. But according to Bart Ehrman, this is the reason why he eventually lost his faith. While his study of the Bible caused him to abandon a high view of Scripture, it was his belief in the Bible's answers about evil that eventually collapsed, and he came to the conclusion that it is the existence of suffering in the world that cannot allow him to be a theist. Dr. Ehrman describes himself as a happy agnostic. Now, I've met Dr. Ehrman, obviously, and I can accept the agnostic part. I'm not so certain about the happy part. I did not get any feeling of great joy in the experience of life in meeting with Dr. Ehrman. But this book came out in 2008. It did not receive the same kind of accolades because, quite honestly, it is not an overly in-depth work. It just basically says, well, the Bible answers this question in multiple ways. I'm awful glad it does because there's a lot of different kinds of evil in the world. But he simply refuses, like most modern liberal skeptics, to allow for any kind of harmonization. It simply has to. He still uses, in essence, a very fundamentalist means of interpretation. He just rejects it and says that you can't go beyond that. And so this is his presentation on the subject of evil. And then, as I mentioned, his most recent work, called Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden... Check out... Now, he says he doesn't necessarily do the titles, but check out this title. Jesus Interrupted, Revealing the Hidden Contradictions in the Bible and Why We Don't Know About Them. Why we don't know about them? Someone at Harper One did not do well in their English classes, and now they're writing subtitles for books, I guess, but... This is nothing but an anti-Christian screed, and I really wish I had known about this. It came out only a couple months after our debate, and one of the things that bothered me so much in the debate was Dr. Ehrman kept saying, you can't ask me these theological questions. I'm not a theologian. I'm not a theologian. I am a historian. Well, then why are you writing books that are pure theology rejecting the Christian faith? If you just simply look at the trajectory of the books that he's been producing, it becomes painfully clear over time that Dr. Ehrman is marketing his apostasy. He is viewed as an apostate Christian, as a former Christian who's come to see the light, you see. And many people who want a reason to avoid the weight of the Word of God coming upon them find his writings very, very helpful. I mentioned, for example, that if you send your kids off to school, they might encounter textbooks like this, Lost Scriptures, books that did not make it into the New Testament. The very subtitle itself is a loaded assertion, assuming that they were supposed to in the first place, or that God wasn't in control of what got there. But this is the kind of material that Bart Ehrman is producing and that your kids will be encountering. Now, I want to let you hear Bart Ehrman. I think it's absolutely necessary when you can do so. And I want you to hear the spin. Here is Bart Ehrman in an interview with a secular individual. You'll recognize it. Listen to the spin as it is presented in regards to the history of the New Testament. And then I will go directly from that into a portion of our debate from January of 2009, where it is his first rebuttal. And I want you to listen to how he addressed the audience. I didn't notice it because I was so focused upon the facts of what he was saying. It was months later when I presented this debate to one of my classes for Golden Gate Seminary, where I was teaching, that I was taken aback myself at the fact that Dr. Ehrman believes his own press. In other words, he really looks down upon the lay people who have not done the study that he has and does not really believe that they can have anything meaningful to say. Or even to engage the subject of the history of the New Testament and things like that. So let's listen to Bart Ehrman in Bart Ehrman's own words.
Welcome back to the show. My guest tonight, a religious scholar and chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of North Carolina. His best-selling book is Misquoting Jesus, the story behind who changed the Bible and why. Please welcome Bart Ehrman. You were someone that went through sort of a period of discovery. You were a literalist, I guess, or born again, it would say, and then as you studied and learned more about it, you began to question that.
Right. I started out being interested in the Bible because I was a born-again Christian, a fundamentalist who thought that the very words of the Bible had been given by God. And so I studied Greek in college and decided to read the New Testament in Greek.
Because that was the original language.
That was the original language it was written in. And so the more I studied, though, the more I saw there's an enormous problem. We don't have the original Greek copies of any of these books. All we have are these thousands of manuscripts from centuries later that have all these changes in it. And so this realizing that we didn't have the original and that some places we don't know what the original said, that had quite a profound effect on my faith that these words had been given by God.
Now, what does that do? Because to my mind, as I read your book and learned more about it, the Bible suddenly became more interesting to me.
Yeah.
In that I felt like that information doesn't denigrate the Bible in any way, but brings it to life in a manner. It suddenly becomes a living document. It is changed by whoever it passes through, which suddenly makes it seem more, almost more godly in some respects.
Well, yeah, it's an interesting point because for me, the Bible takes on new life when you see that the Bible is a living thing, that it isn't a dead document that was written 2,000 years ago. But as scribes copied the text, in a sense, they were interpreting the text and putting their interpretations into the text while they did that. For me, I found it to be a liberating experience to realize this, in part because I realized that the Bible was not only copied by human scribes, it was written by human authors. And these authors all had different points of view, different perspectives, different ideas, and they put all those different views and points of view in the text itself.
And mostly shaped it during that 300 years between sort of Christ's death and when, I guess, Constantine converted and Rome converted and Christianity became sort of the law of the land.
Right. So the authors of the New Testament were writing mainly in the first century, but then their books were copied by these scribes over those centuries.
Right. And those are the Gospels.
Those are the Gospels of the New Testament, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you, James, for that very energetic and intelligent opening statement. I appreciate it very much. Let me speak frankly. I don't know how much of what James just said could sink in with people who aren't in the field. So I don't know how much of what he said actually registered and how much was sounded really intelligent. But I can tell you it was very intelligent. But I do want to make a plea with all of you. I've been asked a number of times over the last several weeks by friends and colleagues why I am spending 3 days that I could otherwise be spending on my own research coming to Florida to have this debate with James, knowing that the audience would be, by and large, evangelical Christians. And I am not. And why would I take my time to do that? The reason I wanted to take my time to do that is because I hope that through these presentations, both James and mine, people will open their minds to other possibilities from the ones that they are naturally inclined to accept. It is very, very difficult to change your mind about something that is a deeply held conviction. It is emotionally traumatic, and most people aren't willing to do it. Most of you here won't be willing to do it. My plea is that you think, at least, about an alternative point of view. What James has just done is given a 30-minute presentation that was in part rhetorically functioning in order to assure you that smart people can hold onto the points of view that you hold. Fair enough. There are a lot of very smart evangelical Christians in the world. Absolutely. But there are other points of view, and you shouldn't write them off because they're uncomfortable. They might be right, and you should not be afraid to go where the truth takes you. I think that there may be only two or three people here who are really willing to open up to the possibility that there might be other views, that other than the ones that they personally subscribe to, that James has just affirmed by giving an intelligent talk. I'm just asking you for the possibility of opening up and thinking that it might be different. I used to believe everything that he just said. I used to agree 100% with the entire presentation. But I changed my mind. I didn't change my mind willingly. I prayed about it a lot. I thought about it a lot. I went down kicking and screaming, but I ended up thinking that the truth was other than what I had believed before. And I hope some of you can do the same thing, because I can tell you it is worth following the truth.
Worth following the truth. I want to play it for you especially because I don't know about you, but it strikes me as so odd to see a man who describes himself as an agnostic preaching. Isn't that what he was just doing? He was exhorting people to follow the truth. But as an agnostic, he can't tell you what the truth is. It is an amazing thing to encounter these men. Some, like Dr. Ehrman, continue to live their lives in an attempt to justify their apostasy. And they can be very, very passionate about their subject. And as you just saw, Bart Ehrman can be that way as well. Now, he was very kind to say, well, it's a very intelligent presentation, but he could somehow read the intentions of my heart, and the intentions of my heart was to give a presentation to allow Christians to think you can be smart and still believe the things they believe. But if you listen carefully to what he was saying was, however, my viewpoint was still untrue. He's not consistent in his epistemology in any way, shape, or form. I did want you to hear one other clip from that debate, because if you encounter people who've run into him, you want to hear this very brief section. A lot of people didn't understand a lot of the questions that I was asking Bart Ehrman during cross-examination. I had certain desires that I wanted to fulfill in the sense of things I wanted to hear him say so that it would be useful in a much broader context than just simply the debate that evening. And so I had spent months listening to Bart Ehrman. Some of you know that I cycle. And so, and Phoenix is a great place to do that in, except in July when you have to get up at 3:15 in the morning to do it or you'll fry. But other than that, it's a great place to do it. And so I listen. I put an iPod on, and now that with my little Amazon Kindle here, anything I can put on here, I can put onto my iPod because this will read it to me. So books, anything I can listen to while I ride 8 to 10 hours a week. And so I had listened to him very, very carefully, to every media appearance he was making, everything else. And he was on the Unbelievable Radio program in London. And he made a statement there, and it just caught my attention. And so I asked him about it during the cross-examination, and listen carefully to how he answers this question. On the Unbelievable Radio program in London, you discussed the length of time that exists between the writing of Paul's letter to the Galatians and the first extant copy, that being 150 years. You describe this time period as enormous. That's a quote. Could you tell us what term you would use to describe the time period between, say, the original writings of Suetonius or Tacitus or Pliny and their first extant manuscript copies?
Very enormous.
Sorry, ginormous would be a good one?
Ginormous.
Ginormous, okay.
Ginormous doesn't cover it. The New Testament, we have much earlier attestation than for any other book from antiquity.
Did you hear that? For the New Testament, we have much earlier attestation than for any other book of antiquity. Now, in London, he's talking about the enormous time period between Paul's writing of Galatians and our first physical evidence of it. And yet I knew, enormous in comparison to what? In comparison to anything else, it's the smallest time period. It's that kind of spin that unfortunately many young people going to university do not have the background to detect, and sadly many evangelicals don't have the background to detect either. And that's what makes him effective as an apologist for unbelief in our day. Now, in essence, here's Bart Ehrman's position. If the Bible was inspired, there would be no textual variance in any manuscript at any time, anywhere. That is his fundamental assertion. I remember the first time I heard him say it, I almost fell off my bike. Because I immediately started thinking of all the ramifications of this. In essence, and he did not say that I was wrong about this. He disagreed with the conclusions, but he didn't say I was wrong about this understanding. If I am understanding his own assertions correctly, from his perspective, God would make sure that every single copyist spelled everything exactly right. I guess automatic writing, you know, I know some people who just can't spell for the life of them, and so, you know, they'd just be about to misspell the word John, and an angel would come down and spell the right thing for them or something like that. Or, you know, they'd get a glassy-eyed look and go into automatic writing or just spontaneously burst into flame before they could misspell something. I don't know how it would work. But somehow, in this man's mind, if there is a single textual variant anywhere, God could not have inspired that. Now, when I asked Dr. Ehrman, well, it follows, given the fact that there are textual variants in the Quran, that you couldn't believe the Quran is inspired either. He wouldn't touch that one with a 10-foot pole because he likes his job and he likes where he lives and things like that. But the fact of the matter is, if you boil it all down, what I said in the debate was, it seems to me then that from his perspective, the Bible, any revelation from God could not have been given until at the earliest 1949. You know what happened in 1949? They invented the photocopier. 1949. Now you could actually make accurate copies with a photocopier, because even the printing press, we know that there were problems with the printing press. You have to have human beings set the type. So until you have a photographic means of reproduction, evidently you could not have God's revelation. That's the only way I can understand what he's saying. He didn't like me pressing him on that, but that was something that I thought was very important. Of course, he also emphasizes that textual variants are often theologically driven. Any variants that he identifies, he tries to find out what controversies were going on. Again, as if we can know exactly what any scribe was thinking about at any given time. The scribe may have just been like my brother who's giving me rides around here. He hadn't gotten his coffee that morning. Might have nothing to do whatsoever with a theological conflict that was going on around him. He may not have even known about the theological conflicts going on around him. There's just no way to get into that kind of long-distance mind reading, and yet that's what much of scholarship is doing. He also asserts that certain textual variants change the meaning of an entire book, and I'm going to look at some of those specific examples as time allows. Listen to what he says, and I'll give you the exact text here. Did Jesus get angry at a leper who wanted to be healed? It depends on which manuscript you read. Did he die apart from God? It depends on which manuscript you read. Does the New Testament specifically refer to the doctrine of the Trinity? It depends on which manuscript you read. Did Jesus confront this woman taken in adultery? It depends on which manuscript you read. That from the Unbelievable Radio program of January 3rd, 2009. So you see the idea that's being presented. is that depending upon which manuscript you read, the entire message of the New Testament can be altered by what would seem, in most cases, to be rather minor textual variants. That's the kind of spin that Dr. Ehrman places upon material on a regular basis. Now, there are two main textual variants Dr. Ehrman cites in the context of the assertion that their reading changes how one reads an entire book of the Bible. And those are, you just heard, Mark 1:41, was Jesus angry with the leper? And Hebrews chapter 2, verse 9, did Jesus die by the grace of God or apart from God? I would like to look at those two examples as an example of what Bart Ehrman is doing. Now, I'm going to do something that Bart Ehrman doesn't do. I'm going to present to you the textual evidence. And I do not think there is a single person in this room that should feel the least bit intimidated by looking at it. I believe that if you do scholarship well, you explain things so that people can understand them. And if you can't explain things so people understand them, you're probably not much of a scholar in the first place. If all you can do is talk with your fellow scholars, that's not being much of an assistance to the church. But I'm also one of those folks that feels that we should call people up to a higher standard, not dumbing things down to a simplistic standard. And so please do not turn me off when I present something about the textual background of the New Testament. It's really straightforward, and I think what you're going to find out is that Bart Ehrman has, shall we say, somewhat of a bias that we might be able to identify by looking at these two texts. And by the way, I gave a presentation on these texts prior to our debate in the afternoon, and I invited Bart Ehrman the night before. I said, hey, by the way, I'm going to be addressing Mark 1:41, Hebrews 2:9, Luke 22:19. Oh, yeah, I've talked a lot about those texts. Yeah, that's why I'm making the presentation. And do you think he showed up? No, he was in the gym. I don't have anything worthwhile to say about these things. See, that's the mindset of so many of the individuals with whom I have interaction. So let's take a look at Mark 1:41. You can look at it in your translation, see how it renders it. Mark chapter 1, beginning verse 40. A leper came to him, begging him, and kneeling, he said to him, "If you choose, you can make me clean." Moved with pity, and that's going to be the vast majority of translations, moved with pity, Jesus stretched out his hand and touched him and said to him, "I do choose, be made clean." Immediately the leprosy left him and he was made clean. Now it is that phrase that I have put in red there for those of you who are colorblind. Moved with pity. That is a textual variant. And that means there are some manuscripts, but not many, that read otherwise. We know the rest of the story, and I want to read it to you. After sternly warning him, he sent him away at once, saying to him, "See that you say nothing to anyone, but go show yourself to the priests and offer for your cleansing what Moses commanded as a testimony to them." But he went out and began to proclaim it freely and to spread the word so that Jesus could no longer go into a town openly, but stayed out in the country, and people came to him from every quarter. The reason I wanted to read the rest of the context is that beginning phrase, after sternly warning him, he sent him away at once. It's literally, he cast him out. Very strong language that is used here that might be relevant to what we are about to see as far as this particular issue goes. Now, here on the screen, you have the Greek text. And up here, you have moved with pity is the term that is found in the vast majority of Greek texts. But there is just a few manuscripts right down here that have a different term. Specifically, manuscript D, AD, FF2, R1, and in its original hand. You notice there's not very many of them, and in fact, these are dependent upon this. In essence, there is one primary main manuscript that has a different word, and it is moved with anger. And being angered, Jesus healed the leper. Now, Dr. Ehrman camps on this, as if Jesus had anger, this completely changes everything the Gospel of Mark says about Jesus. Think about the Gospel of Mark for a moment, and you'll see that that doesn't change everything that the Gospel of Mark says about Jesus. This isn't the only time that Jesus experienced anger in the Gospel of Mark. We'll look at that text later. But the point is, Dr. Ehrman is pointing us to a single manuscript primarily, because Codex D is his primary weight for doing this. What is Codex D? Well, we need to do a little study. Codex D is Codex Beza Cantabrigiensis, which is on your screen. It is a diglot. It is Greek and Latin, and it has some interesting history to it. When Theodore Beza gave the manuscript to the University of Cambridge, he wrote a letter that accompanied the manuscript dated 18 May 1582. In the letter, according to Scrivener, Beza, recognizing the widely divergent text it contains on the whole, suggested the manuscript was more fit to be stored up than to be published. Quote, "The most striking feature of Codex D is its perpetual tendency to interpolation, by which term we understand the practice of adding to the received text passages often of some length, which, whether genuine or spurious, are found in this document either alone or in company with a very few others." That's Scrivener's examination of that particular text. With most critics, it may be feared that the obvious faults and palpable glosses so especially conspicuous in this one book have engendered a natural but not very reasonable habit of unduly disparaging our venerable document as a whole. Scrivener later speaks of the excessive freedom of the Greek text of Codex D. Excessive freedom. Textually, no known New Testament manuscript contains so many distinctive readings, chiefly the free addition and occasional omission of words, sentences, and even incidents. And that, of course, is Dr. Ehrman's own professor, teacher, Bruce Metzger, in commenting on the text. When Codex D supports the early tradition, the manuscript has a genuine significance, but it as well as its precursors and followers should be examined most carefully when it opposes the early tradition, and that is what the case is here as well. The fact is that the longer I have studied it, the more I have become convinced that its many unique readings only rarely deserve serious consideration if one is trying to establish the best available text. And D.C. Parker, by the way, is one of those names really pushing textual criticism into an examination of the variants themselves and the scribes rather than the establishment of the original text. But he's also an author of an entire book on the subject of Codex Beza Cantabrigiensis. So which is more likely, that the original reading has fallen out of the manuscript tradition and all witnesses up to the 5th century, or that the idiosyncratic author of the predecessor of Codex Beza read the rest of the story, saw the strong language used of Jesus' treatment of the man, and altered his text as he had so many times before? Now, I almost never hear Dr. Ehrman talking about any of that information. People are just told, well, there's textual variant, there's early support for it, and therefore it changes the entirety of the gospel. It all depends on which manuscript you read. But there's a reason why you don't find English translations with this as the main translation, because the vast majority of scholars recognize there simply is not enough basis to even give it a whole lot of thought at that particular point in time. There are some who think, well, there might be a reason, it might be reasonable. But does it change the meaning of Mark? Look at Mark chapter 3, verse 5. After looking around at them with anger, grieved at their hardness of heart, he said to the man, "Stretch out your hand." And he stretched it out, and his hand was restored. Looking around at them with anger. How can the Gospel of Mark's message be changed? If it did say angry at Mark 1:41, wasn't there a reason? Doesn't Jesus know what this man's going to do? Doesn't it fit with his casting him out and warning him sternly? It just simply doesn't follow that Ehrman is correct even in his interpretation of this particular text. But what about Hebrews chapter 2, verse 9? Hebrews 2:9 says, "But we do see Jesus, who for a little while was made lower than the angels, now crowned with glory and honor because of the suffering of death, so that by the grace of God he might taste death for everyone." By the grace of God, once again, I've used color here to indicate what the variant is. By the grace of God. In, again, just a few manuscripts, has a different reading. Here is the information that is provided to you in scholarly sources. The primary manuscript that's important here is 1739. 1739 is a 10th century manuscript, but we can tell that it is a 10th century copy of about a 3rd century manuscript. So it goes back, it's an early witness, even though it itself is from the 10th century. And the reading it has is not by the grace of God, but apart from God. Same Greek term is used here that is used in the prologue of John. Apart from him, nothing was made that was made. All right? So if you read a critical commentary on Hebrews or something like that, you'll see an extensive discussion of it in the footnotes, etc., etc. Now, two things. First of all, does this indicate some kind of theological agenda on the part of the scribe? I suggest to you that it does not. Let me give you, and it's amazing what we can do today, we now have entire fonts for our computer systems based upon the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament, so we can reproduce how things would have looked. And here I provide to you, there they are, the two different readings. And this would be apart from God, because God is what's called a nomina sacra. The early Christians would abbreviate specific words such as God, Savior, Son, Spirit, Lord, and they would abbreviate them and put a line over top. It was called a nomina sacra. That's how we even identify a lot of Christian manuscripts in the early papyri. And so God would have only been two letters right here, apart from God, and here is by the grace of God. You can see that charite and chorus are very similar to one another, sharing a number of similar letters. And remember, up until the 9th century, the New Testament manuscripts were written in what's called uncialed text. That is, all capital letters, no spaces between words, and no punctuation. Only in the 9th century did minuscule texts begin to develop, and over the next 150 years, those manuscripts then shift over to the minuscule form. And so as you can see on the screen, there's an easy way of understanding why someone who wasn't paying close attention, maybe in writing 1739 or in writing the manuscript from which 1739 was copied, whatever it might be, could have misunderstood what was being said. But once again, does it change? Does this subclause in Hebrews 2:9 actually change the entire meaning of the book of Hebrews? Now, again, Dr. Ehrman will say, oh, well, this is the only place where it talks about the grace of God in the book of Hebrews, as if there's not tremendous discussions of God's condescension, the sacrifice, and everything else all through the book of Hebrews. It amazes me that a subclause could change the entirety of the message. I've never heard him defend that. He just simply keeps asserting it. Well, yeah, it's a major difference. But does it change the meaning of the book of Hebrews? I do not believe that it does. Now, let me play a brief clip for you. This is an audio clip only of one of his standard presentations. I've heard him give it to his classes. He uses it in his debates, where he's talking about, in essence, the historical unreliability of the New Testament. And here's one of his favorite arguments.
You come up with major differences. Just take the death of Jesus. What day did Jesus die on? And what time of day? Did he die on the day before the Passover meal was eaten, as John explicitly says? Or did he die after it was eaten, as Mark explicitly says?
Well, that obviously is a question that many people have asked many, many times. If you read the Gospels going straight through Mark or straight through John or straight through Luke, you might not have even noticed that there is a conflict or an apparent conflict. For the past 7 years, I've been teaching through the Synoptic Gospels at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church, and we use a harmony of the Gospels, a parallel. So you can't dodge those things. You've got to deal with issues where it looks like Matthew and Mark are saying one thing and Luke says another or something like that. You've got to work through them. That's not the easiest way to do it, but I think it is a very beneficial way of doing it for the people over time. But his assertion is there is a fundamental clear contradiction without possible explanation between the synoptics, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and John, as to whether Jesus ate the Passover and hence upon which day he was crucified, whether it was 14 or 15 of Nisan in that particular year. So how do you respond to something like that? I would like to point out that, in essence, Dr. Ehrman does not allow for any harmonization. Now, you need to understand, for most radical opponents of the New Testament today, harmonization is cowardice. And unfortunately, in many seminaries today in the United States, harmonization is cowardice. The great thing is to say that, well, and I love this, I got this all the time at Fuller Theological Seminary. Well, there's tension in the text. Well, if we give it a neck rub, will it go away? I mean, exactly what does that mean? There's tension in the text. That was how you said, there's a contradiction here, but I don't want to say there's a contradiction because, well, you students tend to be more conservative than us professors are. We don't want to get you mad at us, so you don't come back for the next class or something like that. But the very idea that we should have some kind of humility in recognizing that we are reading ancient documents, we don't know everything there is to know about the context, and therefore might want to give some kind of innocent until proven guilty benefit of the doubt, is abandoned in the large portion of evangelical scholarship today. It's sad to see. You are looked upon as being brave if you just simply say, well, I think Mark blew it here. In fact, that's exactly what a professor said to Bart Ehrman in one of his papers that he traces as being the breaking point where he finally got rid of the shackles of inerrancy, was a professor saying, well, maybe Mark was just wrong here. Not this particular text, but on another text that Ehrman had written a paper on. And so if you actually dare to harmonize, not artificially, but actually ask the question, can we deal with these texts without immediately accusing them of error and ignorance, you're looked upon as being merely a fundamentalist who has an agenda, as if the critics do not have an agenda. They most assuredly do. A few things to keep in mind. Passover lamb was slain on the afternoon of Nisan 14. The Passover feast, the Feast of Unleavened Bread, began that day with the Passover meal that evening, the beginning of Nisan 15. Remember, the Jewish day was sunset to sunset, not sunrise to sunrise. We frequently forget that, or midnight, or whatever, however else we might do that. The Jewish day began at sunset, not at sunrise or in the middle of the night or anything along those lines. Now, the synoptics all agree that on the first day of unleavened bread, Jesus sent Peter and John from Bethany to take preparation for eating the Passover meal. You can read that, Matthew 26, 17, Mark 14, 12, and Luke 22, 7. They all agree on this. Clearly, in the synoptics, Jesus ate the normal Passover meal and hence was crucified on Nisan 15. Many scholars, including modern and mainly conservative scholars, have concluded that John has Jesus eat the Passover on Nisan 13 so that he is crucified at the same time as the Passover lamb on Nisan 14. Now, you will find that in commentaries. You will find people saying, well, you see what John's doing here is he's making a theological point. Whatever else the reasons are, you will find that in published literature as you visit your local Christian bookstore or wherever else you might go. Now, there are five relevant passages in the Gospel of John to examine, and I'll have to do them quickly. Ehrman says that John explicitly contradicts the synoptics. In other presentations, clearly, unquestionably, etc., etc. But is that actually the case? First, John chapter 13, verses 1 through 3. Now, before the feast of the Passover, when Jesus knew that his hour had come to depart out of this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During supper, when the devil had already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands and that he had come from God and was going back to God, just a context question there. It is assumed on the basis of this being before the Feast of the Passover that this means that it was 24 hours before, that is, on 13 of Nisan. But this requires us to read Feast of the Passover as referring only to the initial meal, not to the entire celebration, which lasted an entire week. Instead, the text speaks of Jesus doing things during the supper, which is clearly the normal Passover meal. For example, in John 13, 27, we read, "Then after he had taken the morsel, Satan entered into him. Jesus said to him, 'What you are going to do, do quickly.' Now, no one at the table knew why he had said this to him. Some thought that because Judas had the money bag, Jesus was telling him, 'Buy what we need for the feast,' or that he should give something to the poor." It is assumed that the disciples would not have thought Judas was going to make preparations for the feast if the Passover meal itself was already over. Hence, this must be 13 Nisan, not 14. But there is no reason to limit the meaning of the feast to the Passover meal only, but to the entire Feast of Unleavened Bread, which makes the statement consistent with the Synoptic Gospels. As we're going to see, that's John's normal use. Look at John 18:28. Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not, listen to this, did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled but could eat the Passover. Did you catch that? They don't go in so they won't be defiled so they can eat the Passover. Now, if we go back to the Old Testament, 2 Chronicles 30:22 tells us, so they ate the food of the festival for 7 days. It wasn't just one meal. They ate the food of the festival for 7 days. Since this comment is made early in the morning, remember John 18:28, it's early in the morning. Since this comment is made early in the morning, this must mean the festival, not the supper alone, as why? Any impurities would pass away at sundown. It makes no sense that they would fear having those impurities unless this was the case. This does not just refer to that initial feast that was there, as many people assume. In John 19:14, now it was the day of preparation of the Passover. It was about the sixth hour, but he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." Now here's one that people do struggle with a little bit because of the way that we name our days. But I'm sure those who read Greek here will probably be able to tell you what the day for Friday is. The name for the word Friday continues even to the present time to be Preparation Day. And so when you read preparation of the Passover, that is Friday of Passover week, not the day before the beginning of Passover. That's what everybody assumes to see the term preparation. And if you don't know that that's the normal term for Friday, then you just automatically move it back a day in your mind. But when you recognize it's the normal day for Friday, then you don't do that and recognize that in reality, John is being consistent with what the synoptics have as well. I'll make sure I'm at the right place here. Good. John 19:31, since it was the day of preparation, and so the bodies would not remain on the cross on the Sabbath day, for that Sabbath was a high day, the Jews asked Pilate that their legs might be broken and that they might be taken away. Every day of the festival was a high day, including the Sabbath of the festival. This does not mean the first day of the festival coincided with the Sabbath, altering the timeline. So we see that John is in harmony with the synoptics on this matter if we will simply not assume things and if we will do just a little bit of work. But see, this is what is bothering me so much about not only Bart Ehrman, but in the preparation that I'm doing right now for my next debate in May, where I'll be debating another former Christian by the name of Robert Price. He's a Jesus Seminar fellow, and we'll be debating down in Florida. And that is, if you even begin to ask the questions about, well, are we properly understanding the text? Are we bringing things in that shouldn't be there? Assuming that preparation means something that preparation normally wouldn't mean? Are we ignoring the Old Testament background? As soon as you start saying that, people say, oh, no, no, no. You're one of those fundamentalists. You're one of those people believing in inerrancy. You're just trying to harmonize the text. So in other words, guilty until proven innocent. And in fact, you're not even allowed to do the proving innocent part. It's just simply guilty. And they just don't show any interest whatsoever in recognizing the need in examining any ancient document to recognize that we're a long ways away. There might be some information that we're missing. And therefore, to give some kind of benefit of the doubt in that context. Now, what does the future hold in regards to Bart Ehrman? Bart Ehrman, I just noticed this myself this week in preparation for coming out here. Bart Ehrman has announced he is writing a book titled, How Jesus Became God, From Jewish Preacher to Lord of All, due out from Harper One after August of this year. Now, guess who is going to love that? Oh, my. You know who I hear quoting Bart Ehrman almost more often than anybody else? My Muslim friends. My Muslim apologist friends love Bart Ehrman. Because, see, here's a guy that if you were just honest like Bart Ehrman was honest, then you'd see all these problems. Now, of course, they don't then apply Bart Ehrman's critical thinking to their own text. But that's a whole other issue we don't have time to get into today. But Jehovah's Witnesses, all sorts of people who deny the deity of Christ, are going to be picking this up and holding it over our heads and saying, see, if you would just allow the Bible to speak for itself, you would see where the errors really are. And unfortunately, when we respond to people like the Jehovah's Witnesses, who actually at least profess to believe that the Bible is the Word of God, they've got a perverted version of it, of course, but they at least profess to believe that, we can at least at that point talk as theist with theist. But when we talk about Bart Ehrman, we're talking about the happy agnostic. And therefore, all sorts of people, religious and non-religious, are glad to grab hold of his information and quote it as if it is gospel truth. There's only one person I can think of whose devotees quote him more often as absolute gospel truth today, and his name is Richard Dawkins. And you're probably familiar with his material as well. Though it is interesting, people like Dawkins, Christopher Hitchens, the leading atheists, simply fall back upon Bart Ehrman. They don't get into the text very much themselves on that level. They will just simply say, well, as Bart Ehrman has demonstrated, etc., etc. So what does this mean to you and I? Well, the days when we could sort of roll up into our little communities and ignore the world around us have long passed. If I'm recalling correctly, I got my invitation to be here from Dr. Piper's BlackBerry. Now, that was very impressive, by the way. I thought that was pretty cool because I'm an open geek. I'm an out-of-the-closet geek. I'm not sure if you're still sort of denying that. Or you still are denying. Okay, all right, we'll keep that. I'm speaking from a Kindle, so I'm just a complete geek. The fact of the matter is, we can't insulate ourselves from the internet, from cable programs like that, because it's not just on cable anymore. It comes across the BlackBerry or the iPhone or whatever else it might be. We cannot insulate ourselves from these things. We can't hide from these things. Unlike preceding generations, we have to deal with these things straight on. Now, there have been many generations of church had to do this. The early Christians were attacked on every ground you could possibly imagine. But we are facing a situation that is rather unique in history, and that is we've never been so surrounded by what people are calling a data fog. There is so much information out there, so much good information. I mean, I was telling some of the brethren about the Bible programs I have on my computer back there. It's incredible the information available to us. I can do searches in the Greek New Testament that would have taken a professor and all his grad students 6 months to do in 0.6 of a second. But at the same time, that good information, you also have the bad information. You also have the attacks upon the faith that are all around us. We have to know why we believe what we believe. And we need to know something about our history as well. People have often asked me, what classes do you take in college and seminary that help you the most often when you're doing debates, when you're doing radio programs, whatever else it might be? Two, and I'm talking to seminary students here, listen up. Greek and church history. Greek and church history. Does that surprise anybody? No, I stayed wide awake in the New Testament backgrounds class and Old Testament backgrounds class because I was already involved in apologetics. Those are very important too. But the two that helped me the most were being able to read the original languages and then be able to detect when people were playing fast and loose with church history. Because believe me, they will. And if you know those two areas, that'll help you out a lot. You might say, well, I don't have time to learn those things. I'm not called to be involved in ministry. I don't have time to go to a seminary, whatever else it might be. All right? Still within the community of faith, we need to be talking about these things. We need to be grounding our people in the Word. Not only what it says so you can detect falsehoods, but also where it came from. Because we know once they walk out that door, they are marked. There's a target on them. And here within the community of faith is where we need to be preparing them, grounding them. Bart Ehrman's not going away. Someday Bart Ehrman, like all the rest of us, is going to go the way of this earth. He's going to stand before his Creator. And what a tremendous burden he's going to carry, unless God is merciful to him between now and then. But when Bart Ehrman's gone, there's going to be somebody else, and somebody else, and somebody else, because it seems that in God's providence, the church has to fight and struggle and make our faith real and personal. We can't just get it from somebody else. But as Jude said, we are to agonizomai, we are to agonize, contend earnestly for the faith. I pray God that this brief presentation will help all of us to do so.